Okay, thank you, Rabbi Klein, and I think the chabur is great. It's you should have a lot of hatzlacha, and you should really continue. I apologize. I speak English. I don't speak the proper term, so I'm gonna. Will somebody translate?
I can translate. I speak the same language.
It's not a joke, by the way. With all due respect to proper English, there's a lag time from the time people speak to me after then translate it. Oh yeah, right. Got it. You know. So I apologize. I can't. Can't do the mother tongue, but I'll try in plain old Brooklynese. One of the greatest individuals who lived in the time of the Gemara was Rabbi Elazar bar Pedas. He was known as Mara Deretz Yisrael. He was the Torah teacher of the Klal Yisrael. To his home, to his address, came all issues of the Jewish nation. To his address came all problems. He was the acclaimed leader of the Klal Yisrael. But despite the fact that he was a tzaddik, and despite the fact that he was a true Eved Hashem, he had a very difficult life. Poverty, illness, disease. The Gemara's description of his life is dechikil milsa tuva, an austere, bitter life. And the Gemara gives us an example, a day in the life of Rabbi Elazar bar Pedas. The Gemara explains that one time he went for a medical procedure, and when he came back to his home, he found a bare cupboard, nothing to eat. He reached in the back and he found a clove of garlic. He bit into it and he passed out from malnourishment. Quickly the word spread in Yerushalayim, the great Rabbi Elazar bar Pedas is unconscious. Osi the Shuli Bei Rabbanan, the Gemara tells us that the Rabbanan, the rabbis of the time, came to visit him. And when they walked into his house, this is what they saw. He's unconscious. First he begins crying. Then he begins laughing. Then a beam of light comes out of his head. Kias Oyer, when he awoken, they said, "My high, what's the crying, the laughing, the beam of light?" He says, "In that moment, Yoshev Imi HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Hashem himself came to visit me. And I said to Hashem, Ad Masai Et Star'er by Alma, Hashem, when will my suffering end?" And Hashem said, "Elazar b'ni, Elazar my son, Nichalach Da'apech L'Alma Mereisha, would you like me to turn back the world to its moment of creation? Maybe he'll be born into a time of sustenance." Amarti kulehai v'efshir. I said to Hashem, "You're going to turn back the world to its moment of creation, and maybe you'll be able to provide for me sustenance." The Marsha, one of the commentaries, helps us understand the Gemara. The Marsha explains that Rabbi Elazar bar Pedas was being offered something unique. "Do you feel your life is too difficult? Do you feel it's too hard? Do you want to start over? You want me to put you into a different generation, into a different life, and you could start again?" And apparently, his life was so difficult that he didn't know if he had the strength, the fortitude to continue. So he said to Hashem, "Did I live half of my life? If I lived half of my life, I think I have the strength to go on. If not, I don't know." Hashem said, "Yes, you lived half of your life." Im kein lo ba'ina, if so, says Rabbi Elazar bar Pedas, "I don't wish for you to put me into a different life. Put me back into the life that I had been leading." Then Hashem said to him, "Your reward is an estate that's so wide, so vast, that there are 13 rivers running through it." Again, the Marsha helps us by explaining that his reward is in the world to come. In the world to come, there are no estates, there are no rivers. That's a mushal, a parable. Imagine a man in our world who's so wealthy, he owns tracts and tracts of land, states so large, so wide, that there are 13 rivers running through his land. That's a parable to this man's world to come. When Hashem said that to him, Rabbi Elazar bar Pedas said, "Kulei hai v'sulo, that's all, just 13 rivers, no more." And Hashem said, "If I'm going to give you more, what's going to be left for your friends?" And again, the Marsha explains to us what's going on here. The Marsha explains that when Hashem creates every Jew, Hashem creates for that person a portion in the world to come. Rabbi Elazar bar Pedas said to Hashem, "Don't give me those portions of people who deserved it. Give me those who are unearned, unclaimed." Hashem touched him on the forehead, said, "Giri bach touche," and he awoke. And that's the story as the Gemara relates it to us. And I'd like to share with you what I consider the obvious question on this event. We're dealing with a great man. We're dealing with a tzaddik. We're dealing with a man who lives his entire life to serve his people, to serve his creator. He gets it. And he's suffering. But he's not suffering lightly. He's suffering so acutely that the very first thing he says to Hashem is, when will my suffering end? There are many, many questions he could have asked, many, many shilas. But his suffering was so much there that that was the very first question he asked. So here's my question. Why didn't Hashem just say, okay, Elazar, you're a good man. You've done well. I'll take over from here on in. But that's not what Hashem said. Hashem said, do you want me to turn back the world to its moment of creation? Maybe you'll be born into a time of sustenance. If I were a Blazer Barpadas, I would say, don't turn back the world to its moment of creation. How about a cup of coffee and a tuna fish sandwich? He's not asking for great wealth. He's not asking for Ashiris. He's asking for basic Parnassa. Why not Hashem just say, okay, I'll take over. It'll be good from here on in. And I'd like to see if we could understand this Gemara and understand what it shares with us. And to do that, let me share with you a parable, a mushroom. Imagine an actor gets a call from his agent, and it sounds something like this. Listen, Jack, we got this great script. It's a guaranteed Oscar. I'm going to send it by. You got to sign on the guy, okay? Next day, the actor reads through the script. His agent calls him. Jack, we're going to do it, right? Nope. Jack, what is it? The cash? We'll get more cash right there. We're going to do it, guy, right? I'm not doing it. But why? What's the problem? The problem is the part. The part we have playing, he's a loser. He's a down and out. Jack, this is just the part. You're going to do it, guy, right? Just the part to play. I'm not doing it. I can't stand the whole world seeing me as a down-and-out loser. He hangs up the phone. That conversation never happened. Because any actor, as well as anyone going to the theater, understands that the actor has a role to play. The actor is given a script, and the actor is judged on one criteria. How well did he play his part? If his part to play is the most successful human being on the face of the planet, and he plays his part poorly, the critics will rip him to shreds. If his part to play is an idiot savant, but he plays it well, he'll win accolades, he'll win awards. The actor is judged on one criteria. This was your part to play. How well did you play it? And I believe that that's an apt parable for life. We are but actors on the stage, given a role to play, and we're done. When we are done our job here, Hashem does not ask me, why didn't I be like you? Why didn't I become like him? There's one single question they ask me when I'm done my job, and that question is, how well did I play my part? But ladies and gentlemen, I want you to understand what I'm saying. No human being woke up in the morning and said, Hashem, I think you should create me with 180 IQ. You know, brilliant, smart, sharp. No, Hashem, give me an 80 IQ, kind of daft, kind of dumb. You don't get to choose your intelligence. No one woke up one day and said, Hashem, make me 6'4", big and strong. No, Hashem, make me 4'6", kind of scrunched over. You don't get to choose your physical setting. Much of your personality, you don't get to choose either. And Daniel Goleman, in his book, Emotional Intelligence, writes about studies now that will show the nature of the child at 22 months of age. They can tell bold or timid, extroverted or introverted, because hardwired into the nature of the child is much of the personality. Can you go further with what you have? Yes. Can you take it to its maximum? Yes. But if you even just look around this room here, you'll see that there are vast differences in talent and abilities. And this is the point. None of us are asked to be someone else. None of us are asked, why didn't you become the Chafetz Chaim, the Chassam Sofer Tzaddikim who lived hundreds of years ago? Each of us are asked a much more demanding question. Each of us are held to a much more demanding standard, the standard of you. Based on your talents, your abilities, based on the time you were born into, based on your family upbringing, this is your potential, this was your role to play, how well did you play your part? And I believe while this may sound obvious, I think most people miss this. Anyone know the mantra of the 14-year-old girl? I have four daughters. So I can share the Baruch Shem. They're all past the stage. But there's a mantra. A mantra is something you say over and over and over, right? The mantra of what I call the high school girl, the 14-year-old girl, is, it's not fair. She has such good clothing, and her parents are so nice, and she's so pretty. It's just not fair. Ladies and gentlemen, let me share with you. She's right. If you look around, you'll see that there are vast differences in talent. Vast differences in natural capacity. Some people are social geniuses. They just know the right line to say to the right person, right time. And some people are social klutzes. They can't help but trip over their own feet, say the wrong thing in the wrong time, in the wrong way. I'll share with you an example. Two brothers I know very well. One, everything he touches turns to gold. Financially incredibly successful. Beautiful marriage, and each of his kids, one is more unique than the other. His brother, the other brother, everything the other brother touches turns to mud. Can't earn a living. His shalom bias is on the rocks, and his kids, excuse my expression, one is a bigger misery than the other. But here's the point. Two children born to the same parents, brought up in the same home, went to the same yeshivas, living vastly different lives. And don't tell me one is trying and the other one isn't. There are vast differences in temperaments, capacity, abilities, talents, intelligence. And unless you understand that all of it is irrelevant, you won't understand life. Unless you understand that when I'm done my job here, they don't ask me, was I smart, was I handsome, was I talented, was I rich? They ask me, this was your role to play. This was your talent set. What did you do with it? How much of you did you accomplish? They say in the name of the Vilna Gaon, the Gra, that the worst moment in a person's life is not that fatal car crash, not even when you're aware of the fact that the Hatzalah member pulls that sheet over your head, and not even when you're at your funeral. And they say in the name of the Gra that the worst moment in a person's life is when I separate, when I leave my body behind, I stand in front of the Beis Din Shamala, the Heavenly Tribunal, and they hold up this picture of Tzaddik, this Talmid Chacham, and they say to me, why didn't you become that? Me? Little me want me to be that person, change himself, change, what do you want from me? Says the Gra, the most painful words you'll ever hear in your life are the words, that is you. That is you had you lived up to what you could have been. That is you had you actualized your potential. That is you had you become what you were destined to be. But you see, the picture is a picture of me. I'm not asked to be you, and you're not asked to be him. None of us asked to be anyone but me. The standard of me, how much of me did I become? 80%, 60%, 40%? Once you understand this, life fundamentally makes sense. And if you don't understand this, very, very little under the sun makes sense. And I have a little mushel, a little parable that I'd like to share with you to sort of help define this. There's a story that was written as a novel, later made into one movie, then into a second movie. The story goes like this. A American football player, you know, that's the guy, not the nice little kicking soccer. Anyway, American football player was a quarterback. He's getting ready for the Super Bowl Sunday, which was 3 weeks forward. And to get in shape for the big game, he's riding his bike on a country road. He's riding this way, and towards the end of the road, there's a long winding tunnel. As the story goes, the angel of death on the job that day was new to the job. Angel of death sees a football player coming this way, sees a car coming the other way through the tunnel. The angel of death says, why wait for the blood, the mess? Instead of waiting for the actual collision, angel of death takes the football player out of his body. They bury the football player's body. Everything is fine and well, except one little problem. Angel of death made a mistake. Any regular person would have crashed, deserves to be dead, deserves to be where he is. The problem was he was an athlete with keen instincts. In the last minute he would have veered off, would not have hit the car. He deserves to be alive, but the problem is his body is buried. What do they do now? A whole tumult in Shemayim, what do they do? So they decide to do the only thing they can do, find someone as close in age as possible to the football player. And the football player finds himself put into the body of this rich tycoon. He opens his eyes and sees this mansion, the butlers and the maids. And he looks around the gild and the glitter. And then he feels the flab on his body. Realizes he only has 3 weeks to Super Bowl Sunday. So the cute part of the story is he has the butlers and the maids on the front lawn running football drills with him as he tries to get his arm in shape for the big game. My friends, that exact reality, that exact experience happened to every one of us. I occupy a body. But before I was put into this body, I, the one who thinks, the one who feels, was under Hashem's throne of glory. And Hashem said, this is the generation into which you shall be born. In this birth order, with this set of talents, and these set of weaknesses, This is your mission. This is your stage setting. Go out there. Ford those streams. Climb those mountains. Become the great individual that you can be. But my script is different than your script, different than her script, different than anyone else's. And I believe that's the answer to Rabbi Elazar bar Pardas. You see, great wealth is a life test. When you wake up in the morning and you're rich, but I mean really, really rich, there's a sense of independence, sense of power. I don't need anyone. I don't need my children. I don't need my wife. I don't need God. I could buy and sell the world. That's a major life test. As great wealth is a life test, so too is poverty. When you don't know how you're going to make the next payment, and the creditors call and call, and the word foreclosure is used time after time, and you know you may just lose your house, and you scrape together barely enough money to make that month's mortgage payment, and that night you hit a parked car. You look left, you look right, no one saw. Do you leave your phone number or do you not? As great wealth is a life test, so too is poverty. And I believe that's exactly what Hashem was saying to Rabbi Elazar bar Pardas. It's not that I ran out of cash in your generation. It's not that I don't have enough money to feed you. It's not by accident or by happenstance that you were put into this life. Handcrafted, custom designed for you, the exact perfect life for you to become the great individual that you can become. Do you want me to put you into a different life that doesn't include poverty, that'll still allow you to reach your level of perfection? Efshir, maybe I can and maybe I can't, says Hashem. Why? Because this life has been handcrafted, custom designed to allow you to become the great individual you can become. And I believe what the Gemara is sharing with us is a profound concept. And that is that Hashem didn't mess up when it comes to my life. Hashem didn't create the entire heavens and earth in perfect harmony. But when it comes to me, Hashem, you blew it. You know, come on, couldn't you have done better? Made me a little bit smarter, a little richer, a little funnier, a little... Yeah, funnier would be better, right? Wouldn't sit there, Rabbi Shiv's not saying any jokes. Right? But that reality that Hashem created the exact perfect stage setting for my growth, the exact challenges, gave me a script and says, this is what you can become. And the only question they ask me when I'm done is, how much of me did I become? And I have a parable that I'd like to share with you to understand life. If you want to really understand life in a very, very clear, simple understanding, imagine you're invited to a health club, very exclusive health club, and you know the basic layout. On the right side is the gym, and left side is the spa. The gym has all the equipment you need to get in shape, the Nautilus, the free weights, etc. The spa is everything you need to just sort of relax. You have the sauna, the steam room, massage table. You walk in and you decide it's been a very stressful week. You're heading right to the spa. But by mistake, instead of turning left, you turn right, and you find yourself in this room with all these red-faced people grunting and sweating and all this equipment. Whoever designed this spa did a terrible job. Explains Mr. Sharim, when Hashem created the world, Hashem created two worlds. There's this world and the world to come, each with its plan, each with its purpose. This world is the gym. We were put into this world to grow, to accomplish challenges, many, many obstacles, created specifically to force me to choose to grow, to accomplish. When I'm done my job here, I go to the world to come. That's the spa. That's where I enjoy what I made myself into. Two worlds, each with its plan, each with its purpose. When you understand that, fundamentally, you understand life. If you don't understand that, I claim there's very little under the sun that you're going to make sense out of. I'll share with you a simple observation. Anyone here ever have a headache? Okay, how about a migraine, anybody? Migraine? Little arthritis, anyone? Little arthritis? Come on, yeah. I walked a man up three steps on Yom Kippur. I think he suffered more pain in those three steps than I suffered my entire year. Racking, horrific pain all over his body. Here's the question. If Hashem is more merciful, more kindly, more loving than any human being we could ever envision, as a matter of fact, take any loving, caring person you could ever imagine, multiply that loving, giving sense 10,000, 10,000, 10,000 times. The Chofetz Chaim says that doesn't begin to give you an inkling to the unbridled, unending love that Hashem has for every one of His creations. So if you have a goodly, kindly, loving creator, why create pain? But I don't mean why create pain because it serves some good. Why create pain that serves man no good whatsoever? You see, when you step on that nail, that pain is processed in the spine. If that nerve endings had to go up to the thalamus, and then the sensory receptors had to send it back down, by that time the nail would be through your foot. The pain that teaches you to avoid things, avoidance pain, is processed in the spine. When you touch the hot pot, it's right here the reaction happens. The pain that is transferred, that processes through your brain, serves man no good whatsoever. If you're in bed in pain, racking, searing pain, you don't become bigger and stronger because of it. You don't become more healthy because of it. So if Hashem is loving, kindly, and merciful, why create pain? But if you don't understand the question, I'll make it very clear. When you smash your shin, it hurts. And when you smash your elbow, it hurts. But it's a very different kind of pain. A toothache hurts and a stomach ache hurts, but very, very different. When you have a burn, that's very, very painful, but it's very, very different than a broken bone. You could write poetry about the different flavors and aromas of pain. Why create the pain sensory receptors? Why create the whole process? Why do it? And if you'll search under the sun, many, many times you'll find it does man no good. Once you understand that there are two worlds, you understand life fundamentally in a much, much different way. You understand that there'll be many challenges in life that have been handcrafted for you to force you to choose. You either transcend or you shrivel up, but choose you must. There's no auditing the class, no sitting on the sidelines. You choose, you become forever what you chose to be. Once you understand that, life fundamentally makes sense. And if you don't understand that, the two worlds and very little under the sun makes sense. Now, I get a chance to speak in different communities. And sometimes I get reactions that are a little eye-opening. I was speaking in one out-of-town community, and I got one of those aha reactions. And after that, I stopped. Let me share with you what the reaction was, and I'll tell you why I stopped saying this particular shmooze. I was speaking about what I called, it's a death shmooze, it's shmooze number, I think it's 21. You go on the app, or you don't go on the app. Don't get a smartphone. It's dumb. If you have to have a smartphone, get the Shmooze app. Don't go online. If you have to go online, go to shmooze.com. In any case, you will not hear me say in public again, Shmooze number 21, the death shmooze. Why? Because I was saying this in an out-of-town community. By the way, out-of-town means out of New York. New York is town. Everything else is out of town. Got that? Okay, good. Okay. And by the way, it's not honest. That wasn't true. Brooklyn is in town. Everything, even that's not true. Really, it's Flatbush. Anyway, the point being, I was saying this, the death shmooze, and I could see people were riveted, people were into it, and afterwards many, many people came over to ask questions, etc. At a corner of my eye, I noticed an older couple kind of waiting. So I waited. When everyone was done their questions, the older couple comes by, and the woman comes first, and she says, "Oh, Rabbi, I love the lecture." Thank you very much. Husband follows suit. "Rabbi, I love the lecture, but..." Now, I've been around the block often enough to know that when you hear someone say, "Rabbi, I love the lecture, but..." This was going somewhere. So I waited to see where this was going. "Rabbi, I love the lecture, but according to what you've just said, I've wasted my entire life." Now, when you're on this side of the lectern, and an 80-year-old man is on that side saying, according to what you've just said, he's wasted his entire life, and you know that he might be correct, it's a very uncomfortable position to be in. So I stopped saying that shmooze in public. Okay, good. Want to see? I have to go on shmooze.com. Okay. Anyway, but let me just share with you the highlights, just to give you an understanding of why this man made that comment. Rasul Salant explains that we make a huge mistake about death. Ask somebody to define death. "Oh, I don't know, it's black, it's dark, the hereafter, who can know?" So, Rasul Salant, you're making an utter, utter fallacy. It's a mistake. Death is very simple. If you want to understand death, imagine I walk in the room and I take off my coat. I entered the room. This part is the body. The body's put in the ground. That's the coat that I wear. And I separate. But I means me. Not my alter ego, my distant cousin, my neshama. I used to teach high school guys, right? And I ask guys, why don't you sin? Well, because Hashem will be angry. So Hashem, many Rishonim have flourished, many wicked people. Yeah, but my neshama is going to burn. I don't want my neshama to burn. I'd say to the guys, listen to me carefully. You do what you want. Party. Do whatever you want. Every known sin. Why should you work hard so your neshama should have a good time in order to come? You take care of you and let your neshama burn. Now, I would always say that standing by the door. No one was allowed to leave before I said the answer. I don't want to hear 20 years later, a guy becomes a serial killer. You know, Rabbi Schaefer said, you know, right? Okay? But what is the answer to that question? Says Rabbi Saul Solanzi, you're making the biggest mistake you'll ever make in your life. You see, when you die, it's not black, it's not dark. It's not like going to sleep, like, he's at rest. Harvey was a fine man, he's in his final resting place. The body is the coat. The coat is put in the ground. I separate, and I am for eternity what I shape myself into. But you see, it's me. Not that alter ego, not some splintered down version of me. I who remembers, I who thinks, me the guy inside who tells the arms and legs to move. That's the neshama. I am the one who lives on for eternity. But that's usually not the way people think about death. They get this kind of glassy-eyed look. Oh, he's at rest. Rest in peace. His final resting place. So, to help bridge this gap, let me share with you, again, a mushel. What age do you drive here in this country?
17.
Okay, so I can't... You'll excuse me for doing this in American terms. Imagine you have a young teenager, okay, also about 17, a young boy, and you've done an excellent job bringing him up to be polite, courteous, and respectful. And you're quite proud of the fact. But for the record, he's not the best driver in the world. He's recently got his license, and he's a little bit reckless. But he is very polite. Okay, now, a little bit of social etiquette over here. When you get a text, how much time can elapse before you respond and you're still within that parameter of being polite? Meaning, from the time you get the text until you respond, how much time can pass and you're still considered, you know, not rude? Anyone know the how much?
3 seconds.
3 seconds. What do you mean you're in a shower? I don't care. I sent it over 3 seconds ago. Right? Okay. I don't know the exact social etiquette, but it's not a big window of time. Okay. In any case, your son is driving. He's on this side. Right. And I did mention to you that he's not the best driver in the world, right? Oh, very polite, but not the best driver in the world. In any case, you do notice that the speedometer is climbing and climbing and climbing. And you do notice, I can't do this in kilometer, guys, but help me with this, but it's, let's say it's 70 miles an hour, 75 miles an hour, 80 miles an hour. You want to say something, but you don't want to be that heavy. You don't want to say, but you do. And suddenly he gets a text. Now, again, not the best driver, but very polite. So, of course, he texts back. And he gets a text in, text back, text in, text back. Crash. Shattered glass, twisted metal. 3 days later, you open your eyes. You look up, and the doctor's looking down at you and says, son, sorry to be one to tell you this, you'll never move another muscle in your body again. And you realize, hey, my arms, they don't move. My legs, my chest, my head, help, help, I'm stuck in here, help. Imagine that you, locked inside your body, in that hospital bed, and your friends come to visit. And your friends say those things that friends say when they don't know what to say. Oh, you look so terrible there. Thanks a lot, guy. Not Ben. I'm going to be stuck here. You got something up there. I look. So here's the question. You in that hospital bed, are you alive? Now, your arms don't move. You can't move your legs. You can't sit up. Are you alive? So if you're not quite 100% sure, I'll share with you an interesting observation. The editor of Elle magazine in France, who was involved in just such a car accident, woke up in a state called locked in, locked into his body. And he wrote a book. The book is called The Butterfly and the Diving Bell, describing his weeks and his months living in that state. And he describes what it was like, what he was experiencing. And he describes some of the nurses so kind and so sweet. One was one he called Attila the Hun. And he describes his children, the joy that he felt seeing them and the pain he felt that he couldn't touch them. Amazingly, this man could move one muscle. He could blink his left eye. A speech pathologist devised a method for him to communicate. She put the alphabet on a card. She would move her hand down the card. When she got to a letter that he wanted a signal, he would blink his eye. If you'd like to know that that man was alive in that state, that book that became a bestseller in France, translated into English, later made into a movie, was written by that man in that state. In the mornings, he would compose the sentences and the paragraphs in his mind. In the afternoon, his secretary would stand at the foot of his bed, taking dictation letter by painstaking letter. He wrote that book in that state, and he died in that state. And if you want to see a man vibrantly alive, experiencing the full gamut of emotions, yet his body effectively dead, read the book, The Butterfly and the Diving Bell. But that reality, that I'm not the body, I'm the guy inside, I temporarily am wearing this body, I'm housed inside, but I'm not defined nor limited by the body, is the very essence of understanding who you are. When I went through 45 minutes of this, various people had questions, and this older man came over to me and he said the words, "Rabbi, I loved the lecture, but according to what you've just said, I've wasted my entire life." And I asked him, "What do you mean?" And he said to me, "Well, this concept that you've talked about, that we face challenges, that we grow or shrink depending on our choices, that every interaction with another human being shapes me, molds me, these concepts are wonderful, but I've never thought about them. I've spent my whole life, I've been making money, I've been doing very well, but these ideas I've never thought about, and according to what you've just said, I've wasted my entire life." Now, folks, forget about what you answered to the man in that moment. Here's an observation. What if instead of at 80 years of age, he woke up at 60, or at 40, or maybe at 30? And what if he woke up and said, "Hey, maybe there's a reason I'm here"? What life choices do you think he might have made? But just to make this clear, he was an Orthodox Jew, davening a shul, wearing tefillin every day, and this concept of, "Hey, maybe there's a reason. I get it. One second, wait, I get it. God created the heavens and the earth, yeah. And he made the sun and the moon and the sun. And that means God made me. Hey, maybe there's a reason. Yeah, I got it, yeah. Maybe there's a reason why Hashem created me." That thought never crossed his conscious mind. 80 years on the planet, and the reason behind it all, what he's doing here, why he's here, never seemed to cross the conscious thought process. And my friends, this is a very important thing to realize when you're still young, healthy, and have a life in front of you. Because the choices that you make shape you, mold you into what you'll be forever. This chabur is great. You have Rabbi Klein to help you, and it should have much hatzlacha. I think what this Gemara shares with us is a tremendous insight. What Hashem was saying to Rabbi Elazar Barbadas was, handcrafted, custom-made for you is the perfect life setting. It's not that I ran out of money in your time. Poverty is what you need to allow you to transcend, to become the great person you can be. And we are like that football player. We're put into a body. But there's a script. There are talent pools, abilities, and limitations. And I'm asked one question when I'm done my job. How much of me did I become? How much did I accomplish? I'm not asked, why didn't I become you? I'm not asked, why wasn't I smarter? Why didn't I learn better? Oh, if I could have worked harder, maybe. If I could have really put in more effort, maybe. But I'm not asked to be what I can't be. I'm asked to be what I'm supposed to be. And when you understand that, life fundamentally makes sense. There's this world and the world to come. This world is the gym. We're put here for a few short years. If you look back on 5 years ago and 10 years ago, it passes in a heartbeat. When you understand that this is the gym, many challenges, many, many situations, all crafted for one reason, to allow me to grow, to accomplish. The world to come is a spot. When you understand that, you fundamentally understand life. And I want to close with one last observation. When the Rabbanan and the rabbis came in to visit Rabbi Elazar Barbadas, they noticed three things. First, he began crying. Then he began laughing. Then a beam of light came out of his head. Now, the laughing part, I get. If you were just told that your world to come is in a state that's so wide and so vast that there are 13 rivers running through it, you would find it very entertaining. You'd be quite happy. I get the laughing. The beam of light, I also understand. When Hashem said, "This is your world to come," Rabbi Elazar Barbadas said, "That's all, no more." What he's expressing was tremendous ambition. If you could ever envision and imagine your potential, you're cutting yourself short by probably 80, 90%. And what Rabbi Elazar bar Pedas was saying, there's much more that I could accomplish, much more that I could do. And Hashem said, Giri Bach Touche, you got it right. You should be driven, you should be ambitious, and whatever heights you set as your goals probably aren't high enough. Set them higher, because the potential of the human is phenomenal. So I understand why he laughed. I understand the beam of light. That's because Hashem was entertained by his ambition. But why did he cry? So Rashi in that Gemara, Tainis Chav Gimel, explains why he cried. Rashi says, do you remember the first thing that he said to Hashem? Ad masai et star ba- Hashem, will my suffering end? And Hashem said, you want to try a different life? And he wasn't sure. He didn't know if he had the strength. And he said to Hashem, one thing, did I live half of my life? If I pass the halfway mark, I think I can continue. If not, I'm not sure. Hashem said, yes, you lived half your life. Oy vey! I have all my life gone. Woo-hoo-hoo. He starts crying. That Rashi is a tema, perplexing. He's crying because he finds out that half his life is gone. He should be dancing a jig. His life is Gehenim. His life is suffering, pain, poverty. He's halfway done and he's hitting the highest marks. He should be dancing a jig. It's like, imagine a man running a marathon. And at mile number 20, the judges say, wow, you're setting a world record, just keep it up. Ay vey, 20 miles gone. You don't cry. He should be jubilant. He should be overjoyed that he got through half of this Gehenim called life. Would you like to know what Pshat is, my friends? Rabbi Elazar bar Pedas understood life. When he woke up in the morning, it was with a sense of, wow, 24 hours to change myself and change the very world I live in. Let's go. And because he understood life, there was a lust for life, a love for life. Let's go. And because he loved life so much, the worst words he could ever hear are the words, half of your life is, oy vey, half of the opportunity to be, to go. It was the worst news possible. And if you'd ever like to learn some Musar, I believe that is a Musar lesson. When your friend is kvetching, and your friend is complaining, my life is so hard. Poverty, illness, disease, dechikila milsatuva, an austere, bitter life. That's the Gemara's description. And despite that, he loved life. When you understand life, when you get it, there's a love, there are some pretty rough bumps along the way. And no one promised a rose garden, but there's an inner happiness, an inner joy, and I believe that's what this Gemara is sharing with us. I want to thank Rabbi Klein for inviting me, and I want to wish the Chabura much, much success. Should we do some Q&A? Maybe we shouldn't, because my voice... That's so funny. My voice just went. Is there water? That's really cute. Excuse me just one second. Sorry. Maybe I'm not supposed to take questions.
Thank you very much, Rosh Hashanah. How does one know how far Hashem wants you to get? Let's say, if you want to do a new venture, a new success, how do you know where Hashem wants you to get? Any tips on how we should get what you just spoke about?
Yes. You have to have friends, and you have to have a rav. You have to ask advice. You can't. Typically, we human beings are blind as a bat when it comes to ourselves. I could give you great wise advice. When it comes to me, I'm worthless. So you have to have friends, and you have to have a rav, and you have to have advisors, mentors. Hopefully, a rebbe who can help you. And you ask questions. You ask, and you have to also be able to accept, which is not always so easy. Question. So it's ladies, we take from that side also. If I could see through the. Yeah.
Can I ask a question? Can you just explain about him crying again? It seems contradictory to his question because he asked, if I've lived over half my life, that's fine. And yet he finds out he has and he starts crying. So can you just explain that?
Right. And so his suffering was so acute that he said, Hashem, when will my suffering end? Meaning he really lived in pain. But despite that fact, when he was told that half his life is gone, he realized suddenly, oh my, half of my life is gone. It was terrible news because, yes, it's painful, but this is the golden opportunity of, wow, it's
One second. You know what? I thought, this is the mushel. That's it. I was in Brackman's. Brackman's. So he, the owner, is behind the counter, and the place is busy, and he's moving his. Today, Sunday, it was what? Okay, this is not bad. It's a fine thing. But anyway, he's busy the place, and more people keep mobbing, and the more people that come in, the more bigger the smile gets. But why? He's working harder. There's more pressure. Yeah, this is a gold mine. So look at come on, man. Meaning, when you appreciate that I'm growing, I'm accomplishing. Let's say in that case, you're making more money. What? The point is, when you understand life and you know you're growing and accomplishing, life could be difficult. But when he was told, and it was difficult, and he really didn't know if he had the strength to continue, but when Hashem gave him that news, half of your life is gone, it was so, oh my God, half of my life, that's terrible news. And he began crying. So it.
Reality hit him.
I'm sorry?
Reality hit him.
Right.
Yeah, right. Sorry, can I ask? Yeah. You mentioned earlier that when a person dies, he goes up to Shemaim exactly how he is. So if he is an angry person or if he's an arrogant person, does he go up exactly like that? Or is he a purified version of it?
That's a very good question. So, you want the good news or the bad news?
Just the good news.
The good news is we'll all be angels in white. I'll have big fluffy white wings. You'll have big fluffy white wings. And we'll dance forever in joy and glee forever and ever. Hopefully we'll all be there. And we will be what we made ourselves into. But if you'd like to know, for me personally, the most frightening concept that I sometimes wake up to. So in the early 80s, if anyone remembers word processors from those days, word processors were these big clunky things. And you'd kind of type on it. And if you wanted to underline a word, you'd put an open bracket, a U, and a closed bracket. And that's what you'd see on your screen. But that was a signal to your printer to underline that word. If you wanted to bold a word, you'd put an open bracket, B, and a closed bracket. Again, that's what you see on your screen. And then your printer, that would tell the printer to bold it. Somewhere in the late 80s, technology evolved. And WYSIWYG, what you see is what you get, became the current technology. What you see on the screen is what you get in the printer. So now when you hit Microsoft Word and you click the B on the screen, it's B, bolded. When you click U, the word on the screen is underlined. What you see on the screen is what you get in the printer. When I leave this earth, I will be what I shape myself into. So imagine that we all get a chance to meet again. Hopefully, many, many years from now. After a full and complete life, we get to meet again. And imagine we all see each other. And you get to see me, and I get to see you. And you say, oh, Rabbi Schaefer, I'm very proud. Oh, you worked in that. Oh, very nice. Rabbi. Rabbi. Oh, I didn't know. You see, folks, we all have little dark secrets that we don't exactly want the world to know about. Whether it's selfishness or arrogance or jealousy or whatever it may be. You see, here you can't see me. I hide behind this cloak of physicality and I look so genteel and so proper. But you don't see me for who I am because I'm hiding behind this heavy cloak. When my body is left behind in the ground, when I separate, I am what I shape myself into with all of my great attributes and everything else. Now, Baruch Hashem, there's something called tshuva. And tshuva, it may make sense, it may not make sense, allows you to eradicate acts, events, days, weeks, maybe summers, maybe years of your life. But it really works, and you could really. But if you don't, you is what you is, as Pogo used to say. That wasn't the good news. That was the bad. No,
tshuva was the good news.
Yeah, but it really works. The more it gets rid of, and the more you feel it, the more it gets rid of. But it really does work. But you got to do it. This is important to remember right before Yom Kippur. You know, let's go. You know. Okay, so yeah.
I'm saying in the example you gave of the two brothers,
yeah,
so that's 120 years when they go up. So the one who's got, let's say, a good, not that example, but let's say one who's got a very good midas, and then the one who's, you know, bad midas or what, even, you know, then so he's maybe trying just as hard. Or so what they, when they go to Shemaim, what are they going to look like?
Okay, that's an excellent question. And let me sort of answer it with just one observation. We make a big mistake. We say this person has great midos and this person has bad midos.
this person, I'm sure he has such great midas, going right to Ganeda, and this person has such horrible midas, he's going to Gehenna. I know a man who you would meet, and you'd say, not that impressed. And I can tell you factually that he worked on himself. He used to be a bombastic, arrogant idiot. And he worked on himself, and he's okay. He's not like the most humble guy in the world. But compared to who he used to be, he's a tzaddik. And I'm telling you that I believe his Gan Eden is incredible. You see, you're not asked where you started and where you ended up. You're asked how much you changed. Meaning to say, if one person started very, very humble and they remained humble, they didn't change much. They're not given much credit. If one person started out arrogant and changed himself, they're given tremendous credit. And as you stand now, you have good mitos, that's very nice. Did you make it? How much of you did you become? If you learn to control your anger, learn to control your jealousy, learn to work on yourself, then you're reaching your potential. But as you are, I don't know. It's not as you are now, it's how much you grew, how much you accomplished. So does that answer? I think it does. No? It does to me, but I don't know.
Yeah. Even if one gets excellent midos, he just has to work, make
them
better.
There are people born with excellent midos. They're for what?
Make sure they don't go downhill.
Don't go down, and they have to work. Those areas that are weak, they have to work on. But they're not judged on where they're at. They're judged on where they started and how much they grew, how much they became. Yes?
So in the original answer, that you'll see the deep, dark secrets, or you'll see the amazing qualities that a person has upstairs, is that then changed to you'll see the growth of the person? Because as you said, there could be a person with terrible, deep, dark secrets that no one knew about, and it might look really bad in Gan Eden, but what we don't know is that he's grown 100,000 steps than where he was. So
right.
How does the two... collaborate, if that's the right word.
So those midos that you are oduk in, that you put into you, that you clung to, those are you. Those, what you started from and what you were given as your, let's call it your pekel, as your baggage, you're not responsible for. And those are stripped away. In other words, meaning, you see, let's start the other way. When I leave this earth, one thing changes dramatically. My value system and my currency. Meaning, in this world that we live in, people value a lot of things. Honor, money. Hey, he's got $10 million. He's got, we'll use in pounds. He's got £100 million in the bank. Whoa! It's natural that we have certain values in this world. Again, honor, money, whatever they may be. Instantly, it changes. They don't ask you how much money you have in the bank in the world to come. They don't ask you how handsome you were, how pretty you were, how funny you were, how clever. They don't ask you anything. The one thing that happens is instantly I get it. I understand the accomplishments. I understand the value of a mitzvah. I understand the changes in me that I brought about. And I understand how close I am to Hashem or how distant I am is based on what I did with my time. But in that moment, there's such a clarity, there's such an understanding that instantly my entire value system changes. And instantly I look back on my life and said, what was I thinking? Okay, now. At that moment, so who I am in terms of my jealousy, my arrogance, my laziness, if I made that part of me, it remains in me for eternity. If I was put into a body that had it, but I didn't incorporate it into me, and quite the opposite, I resisted it and kept it at bay, it's not part of me. You know what I'm saying? And it was meaning, some people by nature are heavy. Some people by nature are just, ugh. They have trouble moving, just like they can't, and some people by nature just, that's a teva of the body. Some people, the body that they were put into is more irritable. Stop it, the noise, stop it. It's not anything they chose. Find me an irritable person and woke up one morning and said, I would just love to be irritated by every sound and noise and my wife's voice and my kids cry. I would be, that's great. That sounds just like what I'd like. No one chose that. That's part of their package. Now, if they kept it at bay, worked on it, kept so it remains with the body's buried, it's not part of them. On the other hand, if it wasn't really part of them, but they adopted it, let's say a person got into desire and started really making that a part of, it becomes a part of him, he adopts it, he incorporates it, and it becomes a part of him for eternity, even though there's no such thing as desire in the world to come. But if you get a chance to listen to Shmuz number, I forgot. There used to be a guy in Queens who could tell me exactly the Shmuz number and which one it was. One with Uncle's, uncle is asking advice from his uncle, Titus of Russia. Okay, anyway, we got to go back to Queens and find that guy. I'll tell me what shmooze number. Anyway, it's one of the shmoozen that deals. I think it's 44. I think it's cognitive dissonance. Shmooze number 44. I get credit if I remember. I get credit. are we good? Does that answer the question?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. I talk enough that you forgot the question. Anyway.
On a day-to-day basis, though, I mean, we make choices the whole time, but I imagine 95% of the choices we make on a daily basis doesn't shape us. If I'm choosing which underwear I want to wear, that doesn't shape me.
Yeah.
So how do we know when we make a choice that will actually make a difference?
Okay, I'm going to make your question. It's actually I'm going to make your question even more pointed. Most of our big choices are by habit. Meaning, you ever notice that you respond the same way? Some people are like, hey, good morning, how you doing? Like, there's certain patterned rote responses. Sometimes, you'll say something, why do you say, I don't know why, that's the way I do. Most of our life is by habit and by rote. And one of the great secrets of life is stepping outside of yourself, studying yourself, and asking yourself, are my habits serving me well or not? Are my paths that I'm engaged in, are they good for me? Am I happy with the results? So really, all of Zahiris, which is the second, third, fourth parak of the Mesillas Shaharim, deals with studying my habits, my behaviors, and asking myself, am I happy with the result of them? And then figuring out how to change them. You're right. What socks I wear in the morning isn't going to be a part of me for eternity. But what happens is I create certain habits and certain patterns. They become a part of me. I do them and do them and do them. Before I know it, I can't even, at some point, I'm not even aware that I'm doing them, but that sure is me. And stepping back and studying and analyzing and scrutinizing yourself, more than anything, Limud HaTorah is one of the greatest antidotes because it gives you spiritual energy to wake up, to focus, to begin working on yourself. And that's why learning is such an integral part of everything we do. But you also have to sort of step back and study yourself and see what your choices are, what your habits have become, what you're now habitually doing. So that's a good example of, again, talking and talking and talking. He forgot what he's asking. I forgot what he's asking. And it's all good. I'm all happy. But you know what I'm saying? Okay, good. Thoughts, observations? Yeah, we keep this up until I fall down. I have no energy left. All right, I think...
I was going to say, okay, so the middle of the road from person who davens three times a day learns everything. If you listen to all the musa you hear, everything you learn, you think that basically your enjoyment is going to be in your learning and in your ruchnis. Eventually, your end goal is that enjoyment equals Torah, mitzvahs, everything that we learn in the Torah, basically. And that anything enjoyment-wise, kind of like the cinema, kind of going to the theme park, traveling the world. If you come to 90 years old and that's the kind of thing you're instant where you get your hit from, that's your enjoyment, then that's a bad thing. So my question is, kind of, where does Gashmir?
Could you stop for one thing?
Yeah.
Do I agree with your synopsis of life?
No,
I don't.
Saying,
good,
I'm
but
saying,
go on.
This is very generalized.
Yeah.
A lot of people, their go-to thing if they want enjoyment, even people who learn who are Torah Yidden, they want to travel the world. They want to enjoy Gashmias. And is that necessary? Is that a bad thing for?
Now that's a good question. That question I like.
The end result. The end result. Person, is it right to say that when I get to 90, when I've a normal Pashto Yid has done all the work on themselves, they've fought to learn, to daven. Is the end result so that Yena should want to, their enjoyment is found in Torah and learning, or is it a bad thing if, by 90 years old they still like Gashmias, football? Does that mean that in a way they've failed, in a way? If that makes sense. Is it a bad thing to want Gashmias?
Is it a bad thing to enjoy Gashmias?
Enjoy
Gashmias.
All right. So he spoke
okay,
so long,
right.
He forgot the question. Yeah.
Welcome, you can stand behind the podium and do that. Okay, so let's start from a different angle. What role do pleasures serve in this world? So the Catholic religion is very firm on all pleasures are evil. I ain't never seen that anywhere in the Torah. I've never seen it anywhere in a Musa Sefer. As a matter of fact, quite the opposite. Every pleasure that Hashem created is a tool to be used. But that's the point. The Mesul Shem describes it, our hanas are tools. All pleasures are there to serve a purpose. When used properly, they're enjoyed and they bring you to a higher goal. And when misused, they damage you. So the question is how to use them and how to misuse them. So pleasure for its own purpose is something called hedonism, pursuit of pleasure for pleasure purpose. That doesn't fit into our religion. Pleasure does, but it's pleasures for... No, every pleasure has its time and its place in the right way as a tool to bring me to closer to Hashem, make me more spiritual. And any pleasure that Hashem created was created to be a tool to be used. So I don't think they're to be avoided at all. They're to be incorporated and utilized as catalysts for growth, and they're a very important part. In other words, if a person says, I want nothing to do with this world, this gashmius is all evil, it's not Jewish. It's not a Jewish concept, and it doesn't work. It's Hashem created these as tools that bring you to heights, that bring you to things that you couldn't get otherwise. There's a six-part series on using pleasures. What's it called? I can't pull out my smartphone here because then it's going to be sound hypocritical. So I didn't do this. It's a calculator. It's my big calculator over here. Don't get a smartphone. You know what the I before the phone stands for? Idiot, right? Don't do it. It's just not worth it. If you do, again, you go to get the Shmooz app. It's on Google Play Store and it's on the the Pursuit of Happiness. It's it's 8 parts. The Pursuit of Happiness is an 8-part series that deals. One is called the Pursuit of Pleasure, Holy Pleasures, love of money. That's in learning to appreciate your attitude is your reality. So
we'll do a series.
The Pursuit of Happiness. Don't get a smartphone. But if you do, you get the series. It's too late. Too late. Yeah.
When he started with House and Special, you said you didn't agree with his...
Yeah, because there was like a lot of, you know...
introduction. I think a lot of people, even who people would see us from, they still think my next hit, my next thing that I'm thinking about is next time I go on holiday, next time I go and play football. Their natural instinct is, in the back of their mind, they're thinking, I can't wait till I get home after work and... And I'll, you know, play football and do these things.
Right. Is it a good thing? But the true gashmius pleasure is the reality. Maybe not the learning, however.
Right. The target is to understand that any physical pleasure is a tool to be used. But there's nothing wrong. In other words, there's nothing wrong with using a physical pleasure for as a diversion, as a time out, but again, in the right way, in the right time. The higher level is to actually use it in a spiritual manner, but you know, using it as a distraction, as a sort of a break, I don't think, you know, again, you grow. I'm sorry?
The $1 million question is how much is
how much and how important it is, and is it really, you know, it's meaning, I'll share with you an example. I knew a guy in yeshiva who literally, it was such an incredible masmid, he was living and learning, and I once saw him by the candy machine eating a chocolate bar. It didn't make sense. First of all, the guy was like on a super health kick, and he was like a super sitting there. And I later found out why. Some of the rough times, a little down, and he took a break to have. But he was like using that as a tool. It was like an incredible, you know, to me it was an incredible muscle lesson because, you could have a guy who's sitting there eating a chocolate bar, or a guy who's actually taking a break because he needs a little divert. Just needs. It sounds the same. It's not the highest level, by the way. The highest level is really using the pleasure on Shabbos or again, listen to the series. It's good. It's a good series, I think. Yeah. Okay. Okay, ladies and gentlemen, thank you and much love. Yeah. Yeah.
And Mark was helping. Always, it's because they're not in the 11th.